Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave Krueger. Welcome. I look forward to our collaboration together. We will be talking about various aspects of understanding the psychology and neuroscience of money, mostly how you construct your money story, which can put you in hopefully the best position to listen to and be a catalyst to help your clients develop their money story. First, I don't know if any of you have seen the emails. I got the list of our group fairly late. There are two questions that I ask, and if you would manage the background, even if you're not saying or doing anything, if you move about, it still picks up. Your microphone does, and you don't hear it. So if you would mute, please, *6. Until you're ready to comment, or can I get a mute for all the background noise? Is there any response right now to those two questions? What would be the most important aspect of this topic you'd like to address and have addressed? And if you walked away from this seminar series 4 weeks from now saying it was one of the best ever, what would you walk away with? I appreciate those of you who have already sent in responses. That was quick. I'm going to put us on lecture mode in just a moment and remind everyone. Okay, we're in lecture mode now. I'm going to remind everyone as we get to the other side of this seminar and have discussion to please stay on mute. That's important when we have a large number of people on the call. So we're going to be talking about your relationship with money and the power of your money story. That's our first seminar today. Then the remaining three seminars, we're going to be looking at the principles and the practice of systematically examining and changing that story, a systematic way to do that. Many of you have worked with me before, have heard me say numerous times, if you really want to help someone change, focus not just on the goal, because almost everybody has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. It's the system that we focus on in coaching, creating a map, and each coaching session being a coaching story of that map, what you want to focus on, what the client wants to take away, and then ultimately how they summarize and the action plan they take. So that creates a map. Now, also notice you have two downloads that you can print out and work with. One is your new money story workbook. If you want to print that out, it's printable. You can do the exercises and work tools. The other is an outline for these four seminars, so you don't have to take many notes at all. So I welcome your input, your questions, especially for those of you who haven't responded yet, a response to those two questions that I sent, the email and the reminder of the access information. These seminars will be recorded and posted usually the next day for playback at the same site that you got and had reiterated in the email that I sent. And I welcome any comments or questions. If you have thoughts about either of those two questions, fire off an email. I'll be happy to receive it and look at what you're most interested in and incorporate that into our discussion. It really helps me to know, and I promise I'll notice that and integrate it into our discussion, and then reserve a bit of time at the beginning and at the end of each of the seminars for questions and responses. So welcome then to Coaching Money Mastery. I'm eager to collaborate with you in this series to talk about how to understand money relationships and revise money stories. Now, first, to start off with a sidebar, when I talk about money stories, and that's what our first seminar is going to be about, this is simply a way that we have as coaches to understand someone's relationship with money and basically the surface story, which is the conscious intent, what's intellectual, what someone is aware of. That, as we know from neuroscience and neuropsychology, is only about 5 or 10% of our operating system. The remainder of our operating system, 90 to 95%, is unconscious, and that's where some of the things that we use in determining decisions and pursuits may need to be recognized and made more conscious, and that's some of the role that we have as coaches. So we're going to combine the art of fulfillment and the science of achievement, and in doing that, the point here is that a money story, or our story, is really our concept as coaches. A client does not have a story in their mind. When they see things, it's just the way things are. And with 90 to 95% of that operating system not being conscious, it's going to be a challenge, and that's why they need you, their mentor coach, to help them understand more about the entire operating systems, the ways of perceiving, deciding, processing, and making decisions. That's what we're going to look at systematically as it applies to money issues. So that's the scope. Now, although we'll discuss application to your money story in this series, you're going to see that the principles are fundamental to all change, growth, and success. So my mission is to help you look at the way you think, specifically to help you examine and understand your relationship with money, to map new possibilities and choices, and in so doing, to be in the best position to help your client do that. And my hope is to guide you to look around the corner at the next years and decades of your life, because what you do today can affect the quality and choices, perhaps even the longevity of those tomorrows. So my stretch goal here is to have our collaboration together make a powerful, positive difference for you for the rest of your life. So what we're doing here, and I've never been known for brevity and succinctness, which I urge all of the people I train and work with in the coaching to do, that we are able to really understand our stories and be able to revise them, change them, or to write new stories. So this is basically a look at developing a systematic way to examine what we do and say and think and feel and create and how we coach that. So as we go through these seminars, I suggest that you actually do the exercises in the accompanying workbook. Then you're going to be in the best position to coach it. From Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So put it into action. And the immediate action with each of these seminars that I'd suggest is to write down your most important takeaway. That way, you have put in an output channel what you're learning, what you're taking away. That's what makes it, we know now, a complete story, more memorable and more accessible. Here's a simple example of that. University of Waterloo did a study of a large group of people reading the same passage in a book, half read out loud, half read silently. They then took a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel. And remember, this is what we ask our clients at the end of a session. What's the most important thing you're taking away today? And then based on that, what do you commit to do before we meet again? So first, let's talk about a very specific relationship you're in and a very specific story you're writing. Now, you're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It doesn't even seem like a story. It's just the way things are. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, you think about several times a day, and it's remarkably simple yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, and even unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you've departed. Maybe you'll get 10 years out of a car, 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you still orient life decisions around it. I spoke with a well-known author and ultimately editor of a very prestigious publishing house. We were talking about a book, and he said, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." It was the simplest way I've ever heard anyone put it. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your moods, to adjust self-esteem, to influence others, or even to soothe or calm emotional pain. And, this is so important, how you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients and those close to you, including employees. What they see in your behavior, what they hear, even sense as your beliefs, will be what they may use to incorporate as their own. Just one or two more things briefly. The villain or hero is the most popular of this story, is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you. You speak with it. It's your money story. As Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. So I'd like you to write down your immediate answer to these two questions, probably one word, but your immediate answer as soon as you hear it. Number one through three. How much do you make right now, money-wise, annually? Just write down a figure. Two, what would it take for you to make annually, in terms of money, for you to be happy, worry-free, very content with your money? And three, write down one word of what money means to you. One word, the immediate first thing. I'm going to come back to this. So I want to consider two questions here specifically. What is your money story and what you ideally would like that money story to be? So first, what is a money story? Your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, net worth. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale that you tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. And it's a running dialogue of how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, even how much you think you're capable of. And it's also about what would happen if you had more or less. So let's look at some of these and highlight them just a bit. First, how we speak with money. In some ways, we speak a very straightforward way about money and with money. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. Money can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, but also what we fear and lack, and what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We may use money to show how much we care or how little. We can use it to measure success, to buy happiness, or try to bolster self-esteem, regulate moods. We use money, in other words, to communicate. We use it as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it. We give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it is. I'll give you some examples of these in just a bit to bring it alive even a bit more. We can use money to soothe emotional pains, buy the respect of others. We also use it as a self-statement. Money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. A self-statement really means that all you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements. The story always tells most about the teller. And here are some things that money can say as a self-statement or attempt to. A proclamation of freedom, a currency of caring, a promissory note for happiness, embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, instrument of control. We see a new car and want it, but what we're really doing is kind of acting out our money story, because just below consciousness, if it is, and many of us would wish things to be far more unconscious than they really are, we're adding a new plot line. This car is going to show how much I'm worth. This is going to make people respect me. This is going to validate things. It's worth it for all that I've worked. Now, an obvious example is a self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy that red 540 BMW in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a statement. I'd never buy a red car. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. Think about how that may show itself in self-talk about assumptions, some of which are conscious, some are not. People who have significant money are lucky. People with real money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Well, money is going to buy happiness. Money means the same to everybody. Now, contrast that self-talk to an external dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Remember, our next three seminars are going to be about how to really systematically understand your operating system, conscious and unconscious, about the creation of your money story and what you do. Our social conventions create pairings of what's spoken and unspoken, what's okay to talk about and what's not. We can talk of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not somebody's age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your dinner party, how much money do you make every year? And you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? You may not see dessert. Now, here's an example of this. A well-known literary agent, if I said the name, you would immediately, I think, recognize her, was at a writer's conference discussing how she worked with her authors over the year. And she was talking about the details of contract negotiations. And she was almost wrapping up. And finally, somebody in the audience, it wasn't me, said, would you talk about how much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? She had not mentioned that yet. She looked kind of shocked. This is a very well-known international agent. She looked shocked. And her immediate response was, I've always felt that you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. And then somebody else in the back row said, well, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course, he was right. His frankness and confrontation, both of them actually, sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion useful to her audience interested in writing books for a living. How many people, after training, have you talked with about your professional fees? Another aspect, an internal dialogue. We may not speak openly of something, but our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time, and energy for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, can have several dialects. Let me give you some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned, this tells you how long ago it was, 10 cents a row chopping cotton for my dad on hot summer days. When school, and a big day, a big morning, for example, was 60 or 80 cents. Well, when school started, my classmates all went to the stand after lunch and bought a Coke and candy. I did the same thing. Then, immediately, I asked, was that candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? And did I really get enough from this soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? It took me a fraction of the time to consume both. After that, I answered no to both questions because I came to recognize the cost of money that day. Because we usually talk with our kids, you know, about the value of money, even how to spend money. We may do, as I did with mine, a clothes allowance twice a year and help them think about and think ahead about, you know, what they may need for the winter. But yet, an important aspect of that is what's the cost of money? And when you earn it, you really get an idea of the cost as well as the value and the strategy. Some other examples. At an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. The preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on a plasma HD big screen TV, but if I spread it out over the next 10 years, it's 27 cents a day. So my wife said, if you want the TV, Dave, just go ahead and buy it. Now, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money spent without debate. Salary or professional fees, serious comparative choice. Savings, relinquished only with a definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias because it's the same dollar bill, but it's treated differently based on its context. For found money, as George Costanza said, it's just found money. I got to bet it on a horse. From a recent documentary, a woman on the verge of declaring her fourth bankruptcy said, still, the high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. And a final example, the parent who says, you know, I spend so much time at work. When I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it. A justification bias. Now, a compromise occurs when two money stories are written simultaneously. And hear how you may be hearing this from your clients without them being consciously aware of it. The surface story, and this is what's conscious, logical, intellectual. This is what that 5 to 10%, the tip of the iceberg of awareness is. Well, I'd like to make significant money and accumulate wealth. But the shadow story, that other 90 or 95% that's not conscious, you know, I don't think I have what it takes. Or making a lot of money is unspiritual. Or I've always been this way. I don't know that I could really change. There's always some reason that follows the stopping yourself. And the shadow story, if it's in contradistinction, if it goes in the opposite direction of the surface story, that creates a stuckness. So we're hearing, and you're going to be hearing more and more clearly and specifically, shadow stories as they manifest in the conversation with your client and in the relationship with you. Here's another example of a dual story of conflict, the surface story. I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority. The shadow story, well, I can't have that total authority because my partner acts like I'm taking it away when I do. Now, another aspect, money speaks to us. We're looking at a number of perspectives here. A study was done in which volunteers had their brains scanned using fMRI when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. You know, as a sidebar here, I have elaborate mechanisms to get research, papers, books from around the world, even correspond with a couple of neuroeconomics labs, but I've never found a study like this to volunteer for when you get free wine. The volunteers were told before tasting the price of each of the 5 wines. So they knew this from the start. They rated the wines then in a semi-blind testing. They rated the wines, as you might expect, according to price. They rated the most expensive one the best and on down to the least expensive as last in the pleasure of test and the quality. And their brains corresponded. They were hooked up with fMRI. As I mentioned, the area of the brain that encodes the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the most expensive wine and on down corresponding to their subjective rating. Now, the volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. Money sometimes communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us as confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, or drug. Money can serve as a tangible container for any number of the things, including whatever you wrote down as what money means to you. Freedom, ambition, love. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. So, go back to your 3 answers on that money quiz. Current annual income, to ensure happiness, what money means to you. This is a question of what is enough. I've given this quiz to hundreds of people over the years, beginning with when a first book, a professional book in psychiatry psychoanalysis came out about money, and I did presentations to groups of executives and other groups, and would pass out index cards with 3 numbers on them and ensure that these would be treated confidentially so that nothing would be seen by anyone and ask them these 3 questions. Here's what I found when I then tabulated later their responses. Somebody who makes $50,000 a year, it would take roughly $100,000 to be financially content. Somebody who makes a $500,000, it would take close to $1 million. Over 90% of people believe that it would take a double amount of what they made now to be content, happy, worry-free about money, whatever their income was. If it was 50, they thought it would take 100. If it was $500,000, and in follow-up study, there was a doubling effect. In other words, somebody who thought, who made 50,000, this was way back, this was several years ago when that meant something. When they made 50, thought it would take roughly 100,000. When they got to 100,000, they thought it would take around 200,000. So this raises the question of what's enough. There's no end point of wanting more. Usually that's what we see with somebody who sort of keeps hope alive. There's no limit to what you don't have. When you focus on more, you both ensure dissatisfaction but keep hope alive. I need to make twice as much to really be happy. That's how I first began to get interested in money stories, because as a psychoanalyst, I would hear people who had significant money who didn't need any more money. They had funded their pension plan. They had their home and vacation homes paid for. They didn't need more money, but yet they kept hope alive by thinking that when they make more, they'll be happy. One guy, a supremely accomplished guy, came to see me as a shrink. And I said, what brings you in today? Let's talk. And he said, well, I ran out of wall space. I said, help me understand. He had achieved in his profession the epitome of every achievable, awardable thing, and three of his walls at his office were filled with awards, trophies, plaques. And when he put up his last one, he realized he ran out of wall space. He didn't have any more room for any more. So he had to look at, is more, whether it's awards or more money, is that really going to make me happy? Or have I just been kicking the can down the road? Have I just been keeping hope alive doing that? So three, let's look at your answer to that last question. The one word of what money means to me. Money can make any statement. Worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs can show up as symbolic wants. A desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and actually desires can be created by fulfilling them. Money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. Our eyes look straight at an image, but it's just a design on paper. But when asked to imbue that image with meaning, what do you see? The interpretations are going to be as wishful and varied as the fantasies of the people who respond when they look at that dollar bill or whatever its representative is now. We'll talk about that more in a minute. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth or even something as, it seems distant or illogical, as their morals. One woman said, well, you know, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. You know, I go to church regularly. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, money isn't related to morals. I mean, look around. Look at some of the people making news, and you'll be assured money is not related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Are there ethics? President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, you may work hard, but you may overspend, you may gamble, you may have five kids, three of whom are college age, you may live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or you may have a shopping addiction. So there are a few exceptions. Now, here's a question. Write down your answer, because I am not going to take you off mute for this. We're going to do that at the end. Write down your answer. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Of any group, ethnicity, race, job description, who has the best work ethic? Write it down. You ready for the answer? Heroin addicts. They get up every morning. They have to hustle 7 days a week, plus holidays, 365 a year. They can't let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem suffers. one heroin addict summarized it by saying, if I don't get up early every morning and hustle all day, the next day I'll die. So I mention that to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic, and especially with success ethic. How many times have you heard somebody, well, I've been at work all day at my desk. I worked 8 hours, just took one break. That's a good work ethic. So we may want to expand that view and put on a wider angle lens, at least a little bit, about performance and success and the strategies to do that, which is also what we do well in coaching. So why do we make these money errors? Well, in a way, the more we give money meaning, the more we may lose focus on what money really means. And then we do strange things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people can get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Reasonable people can forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Think about that in slow motion. Gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Balanced individuals may spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Dependable people can ignore financial matters until they're serious. Highly principled people can step over boundaries, write their own rules. Others are even taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of CyberNet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Well, Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that can imprison them until they're listened to and strategically changed. Now, in thinking about it, money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands or broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring. Here's a 22-second history of money, since you ask. First, a couple of goats were exchanged for 5 bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins were then replaced by paper bills that were still tied to actual gold. Then, paper bills that were tied to a promise. Then, paper checks, kind of tied to a promise. It says, I think I got it in my bank account, so I'm going to write you. Then plastic. Then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money has become more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money can fade, and our relationship with it changes. So let's look at tying this into the mind, brain, and performance sciences. What's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The shortest answer is everything. So first question, and some of you who have done some collaboration or courses with me before have heard this, but it won't hurt to listen to it again. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? In other words, what keeps people, your clients, from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? This conscious, logical, and intellectual. Why will somebody repeat behavior that doesn't work, sometimes do it harder, and expect a different result? Kind of like if somebody doesn't understand English, you repeat what you said in English louder, as if that's going to. Even when it leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So to this question, why do we resist change, even a story that doesn't work? Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure. It's predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting, or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That can create the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty and trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe or comfortable changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality. So that's what we're going to have to address to make change permanent with a client, is to help them transform their operating model of how and who they see themselves. Let's call that identity for right now. This is the internal map that's synonymous with identity. And we're going to return to this default mode and look a little bit more at it. Do one brief exercise. Put your palms together in front of your chest and interlock your fingers firmly so that your palms are pressed together, your fingers are interlocked firmly. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, but change one thing. Change so that your other thumb is on top. Now, register how that feels. Kind of awkward. Now, move your thumbs back to their original place. Ah, that's kind of really, that's the way things ought to be. That's why people don't change. Or succeed remarkably, or derail when they do, they return to their comfort zone. Now, add up the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, like a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk about comfort zones and how to program change. And here's what's important to remember. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new, because that's how our minds and brains work. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. Here's a story that will illustrate, I think. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood. When it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so he could create a fresh path in the snow. This was in Arizona, so it didn't snow that much, so he relished that. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him, he was always first, each person who followed him followed the same path until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its circuitous route. No person started a new, more direct route. Increasingly, he would do more diabolical twists and turns, but each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, and they become automatic. You don't think about it. Even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work, you don't trek into a new pathway. To think creatively now, and this is where we earn our money, new neural pathways must be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. There's no default mode to automatically activate. The catalyst for insight, a novel stimulus, new information, a new context, converting a problem into a challenge, converting a stuckness into a look at what's one thing you could do to get some traction on this. It's how we ask the next step, how we create a system beginning with where the client is this moment. So we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage in new behavior, and our resistance to that. The uncertainty of this newness can be read, this is thinking about reframing this for a client, if they're taking a step in a new direction, doing something that immediately registers a discomfort, and the error detection mechanism of their brain says, this is not what we expected, and that's a real structure, they can read that as, well, this, you know, my gut's telling me this is not the right thing, or my intuition is saying this is a bad choice. This is where we may need to help someone reframe that this is a register. This is their experience of doing something new and different, not wrong or bad. And this can be a signpost of being in new territory beyond where you've been before. The validation of moving ahead one step at a time. That's a reframing. How you frame something determines the mindset someone uses to boot up an entirely different approach to what they're dealing with. We'll return to that in a bit. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. And the brain's error detection mechanism, located very close to the emotional center, says this isn't normal when we try something new. So we'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. This is why I think it's so helpful for us as coaches to know and integrate the mind, brain, and performance sciences with strategic coaching to help someone go all together in the same direction, align needs, ideals, and how their mind and brain work to frame what a successful journey and map can be. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operation. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. That's what we're going to look at. We're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change in order to guide strategies of change in simple conversations with our clients. We even at times have to outsmart our brains, but we can reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create a money story that is significantly more successful than a current one, perhaps. So, how do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? The brain has a mind of its own, and we're of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by fMRIs, functional magnetic resonance imaging, a video of the brain in action, and how it responds to different situations. Now, these studies have disproven a long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and response, and they choose based on logic. Well, behavioral economics, neuroscience, psychology says that ain't true. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. So money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activity. We're going to use these findings to inform certain decisions. Now, some simple examples. The prefrontal cortex, the logical part, says, let's think about a 12-month game plan and retirement savings. But the limbic system says, relax, let's have a cognac and order that 27-inch iMac. Now, my amygdala even specifies the brand of actually single malt, if I'm going to tell you the truth, with cigar. Now, each part of our brain struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. But emotions don't simply and only corrupt decision-making. They narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate and lose sight of the big picture at times. But those individuals who feel no emotions are not good at making decisions. So this is an integration. So also, making people happy is not simply giving them more of what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects them to continue. David Geffen said, anybody that believes money makes you happy doesn't have money. The important thing about your money story is to determine what works and what doesn't. The components that don't work may need examination, reflection, and looking at the assumptions. Because how we, again, back to how we frame something. Think about what you already do in coaching. Someone begins to talk about a problem, and you know, if left uninterrupted, which is why I have an agreement with every mentor coaching client I work with, I ask for permission in the first session we have. May I interrupt you if I think it might be helpful for us to look at something you said at the time you do? And I give them permission to interrupt me. This is not, you know, one-sided. So if someone begins a framework of, well, let me tell you about the problem, you know they're off and running, and several paragraphs later they're going to be energized, but there's not going to be anything new because they've got that down. That's the most common addiction we have as humans, is problems. Left alone, two people on the patio with a glass of Chardonnay each, they're going to be talking in an animated way about problems or some scenario that involves a problem quickly. So when a client begins to talk about a problem, we may interrupt because we know from neuroscience and cognitive psychology that when, and this is why some people get stuck in therapy, when you pursue a problem, even ostensibly for creating a better ending, even 1,000 better endings later, it etches the problem tracked in our brain even further. So we may want to interrupt. What's the opportunity here? What's the challenge that you can direct? Now, that's new and different. That may not be what somebody's thought about before. The whole area of appreciative inquiry, I think, is something we haven't quite applied yet as much as we might. But in that field, Dr. David Copperfield, who does consultation to organization, did some studies in which he went into half of the organizations and asked the usual question of a consultant, what's the problem, and set about problem solving. In the other half, he began with, what's the opportunity and challenge here? Those that he did that opportunity and challenge framework were significantly happier and ultimately, in follow-up studies, significantly more successful in engaging in that way. That's what we do with our clients. You know, they talk about something and they stop themselves, and if they admit it, yeah, I kind of felt anxious or uncertain. Our brains can't tell the difference. It registers in the same way for anxiety and excitement. Same activation. The brain can't tell the difference. Once you frame that, though, that determines how you proceed. If you frame it as anxiety, then you look for danger, you better head for cover, you protect, and you contract, perhaps. If you frame it as challenge, as opportunity, if you frame it as excitement, you look for the challenge and the opportunity, and that opens new possibilities. A very different mindset, very different software. So the software that you boot up for how you perceive something and even label it without even thinking about it consciously determines that concept. Think about this book title. This is one of my most followed social psychologists, researchers, academics. One of his more recent books is simply called Don't Think of an Elephant. And his book is about mindset and framing. So the important thing about your money story is to look at what works and what doesn't work. This is where we come in as coaches, if that manifests in the conversation. The components that don't work may need fixing, understanding, and revision. The ones that work, maybe to do more of those. I mean, that's basically a summary of what we do as coaches. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. And to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money, your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story, because money is a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, Money will make them more drunk. If someone's insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone's caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money or finances or economics. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and how that affects our behavior, including about money. The beliefs and decisions and the seemingly inexplicable, inexplicable behavior involving money aren't about money at all. Money is a portal to the immaterial and the intangible. So we began together a journey to understand the choice architecture of your money story. You write your money story, live it, can revise it, and write an informed, powerful, new money story. I'm going to take us off lecture mode if you'll manage the background noise, because I'm interested in any comments or clarifications or questions that you have for any aspect of this. We're in discussion mode, so any comments or questions? I couldn't have been that clear. Are there any responses to either of the two questions about what you'd most like to focus on in this series, what you'd like to take away from this series? Any responses at all?
Good evening.
Thank you. I was beginning to feel lonely. Go ahead. Who is this?
My name is Enyla Shaw.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you so much for this question. I am a financial advisor by profession, and it seems like most interestingly and seemingly new, there's a lot of questions around financial behavior and how it kind of makes one make a decision or choice regarding their investment.
Around financial, what was your second word?
About making decisions or choices regarding their investment.
Okay, all right, got it.
Mm-hmm. And so when you made the point about, you know, the think and feeling part of the brain, I'd like to see, I'm hoping in the next sessions we'll kind of expound on that, because I know a lot of the behavior is the thinking and feeling part that clients have regarding their money. But you challenged me to think about, you know, beyond the surface, that part, when you're going to dig in a little deeper in there, I think there's going to be a lot more other than money that surfaces around my why and my how to get out of my home situation.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think you are right, and I think you'll see how right you are, that we're going to approach that in two fundamental ways. One is when important decisions, including financial decisions, are made, that someone be grounded centered so that they have access to all of their states of mind and become that search engine rather than being in a particular state of excitement or any other state that can alter a state of mind. And that means that a particular software program is booted up and somebody can get locked into that. So being grounded and centered is the best place for reflection, for insight, for introspection, and making decisions that require balance of the thinking and feeling parts of the brain, all aspects of the brain, because that's kind of a primitive way of that I've divided in the thinking and feeling brain, the left and right, because it's way more complex than that. Another aspect of that we're going to work more on, too, is to create a systematic way of assessing a story, such as a money story, and we're going to be looking at a 7-step process to look at and understand the components of any story and decision-making. For example, or to illustrate, in working with one of your clients or in working with the clients of the coaches, every important algorithm that someone has embedded will show itself in the conversation in terms of how someone approaches, decides, understands, and makes decisions. So this is what we want to know, is how to look at and understand the elements, the components of a story, and then how to address an aspect of that that may not be working. So this is the roadmap system, the seven-step process of understanding and assessing someone's money story. So we're going to go into that, and then we'll look at the various things that can influence that in terms of state of mind that is really fundamental. First, and the coaches in our group know this, first, state is more important than strategy and story, because state needs to be grounded, centered, regulated, then to look at developing an awareness and strategy around the elements of the story, the strategies and the goals of pursuing that. So those of you who haven't sent answers to those questions, and they're really important to me, send your answers to those two questions about what you'd most like to focus on, most like to walk away with, to just fire it off to my email address. Thank you for those who have responded. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Next time we'll be talking about some specific aspects of writing a different money story, looking at a roadmap for a money story. So we'll be looking at the first components of that next time. So thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves, and we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks again.
Thank you.
See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
Absolutely.